Thank you. Thank you very much, and thank you all for coming. Who didn't get a chocolate? I'm trying to get rid of Christmas candy. You know, if anybody wants any, please help yourself, or I'll pass it around. I really don't know how to start, except to thank you for sharing this new experience with me. This is the first commercial book signing and talk I've given about this labor of love. And it's just wonderful to see so many smiling faces. And I'm curious, and a little bit later I'm going to ask you what drew you to this this talk today and this book signing. I want to tell you a little bit more about me and my motivation for writing the book, because it's important to understand that I didn't write this book alone. You heard a little bit about the fact that I've been dealing with people going through various crises in their life, many of whom were terminally ill, or they were caring for a loved one who was going through this process. But there are many different types of losses we experience, and grief is grief. So I think some of the principles and lessons that I learned through caring with people going through the dying process applies to life. And as a matter of fact, I was talking to a gentleman the other evening who said, I just finished reading your book, and I've been meditating on so many thoughts. And one thing that occurs to me is the fact that this book is not about death. This book is about life. And if you want to know how to live, just ask somebody who is nearing the end of their life, or somebody who's dealing with a life-threatening illness, and you start to reflect on what's really important. And because I had that privilege of working with people in all these different situations, they were able to share with me. They gave me so much wisdom. One of my chapters in the book is called Living Libraries, and I really think that that's an appropriate title, because you can learn so much from each other. And I just wanted to share this with so many people. The gifts I felt were really a legacy. And a legacy is something that you really can't keep to yourself. It has to be passed on. And Roger and I have not been blessed with children, so this was my way of sharing this legacy with other people through the writing of this book. The title is Sacred Walk. Is really just that. And if any of you have had an opportunity to befriend somebody going through a crisis, you know, any kind of a crisis, you know how precious and how sacred that time is. As somebody takes you into their confidence and you're able to be there, a listening presence with them, it really is a privilege to do that. So to me, it's a sacred time. The subtitle kind of captures the essence of the book. It's Dispelling the Fear of Death and Caring for the Dying. Dispelling the fear of death is important to me because I lived with the fear of death well into my adult years. I've had, and you'll read about it in the book, the second chapter is called No Stranger to Death, where I recount the early deaths in my life and how I reacted to them and how that formed the foundation of the fear that I had, until my grandmother called me one day. She had been given a prognosis of about 4 to 6 more months to live. And the telephone rang, and she said, Donna, I need to talk to you about my children. Well, I got a lump in my throat that she's talking about my mother and my aunts and uncles. Why is she calling me? She said, I can't talk to them. They won't let me talk. And I have so much I want to say, and I think I can talk to you. So I drove to Pittsburgh and brought her to my home in Ohio, where I was living at the time, and we spent a full week together. And she just shared with me all of her thoughts, and I had the opportunity to ask her questions about the family secrets maybe I didn't know. And she was very kind and answered them all. It was a very special time for me. And the third chapter is called Grandma's Final Gift, because it was through this relationship and walking with her to her last breath that helped dispel the fear of death. It made me look at life and death differently. And that, I think, formed the basis of my getting involved in caring for others in the same situation later in life, after I finished my professional career. I was working with IBM at the time. Okay? Now, that to me is very important, because if you can dispel the fear of death, you can live freely. You don't have to worry. You don't have these worries on your brain of what's going to happen to you if you really delve into, you know, the basis of your fears and explore that and ease those fears. There is another chapter in the book called Hospices for the Living, and in that chapter I talk about the 7 fears of dying. And you'll want to read that, because people don't only fear death or the dying process. They fear many, many things. And really, I found in providing a listening presence to these people, a need to talk about these things that are going on in their head. Many times they don't want to talk about it with family members or some of their friends, because it's so emotional. And the people that are that close to them can't really handle it themselves. My mother would say to me, if I start talking to you and you start to cry, then I'll cry. And if I start crying, I won't be able to stop. Which is another reason why he mentioned in the introduction that I've been involved with Stephen Ministry. Stephen Ministry is available in 5 different churches in Charlottesville. It's a program where lay people within a church are trained to be a caregiver to somebody. And they don't have that emotional attachment, and they can be with someone and are able to listen and help people think through the topics on their mind and the issues and concerns they might have, or the choices that they have to make. And they need someone to bounce ideas off of. And oftentimes, somebody very close to them is not capable of doing that because of their own emotional intensity in that situation, right? So you'll really, if you want to help somebody else dispel their fear of death, read that chapter. I think it'll be of value to you. And I think that once you are able to come to terms with your mortality, as was I, and many of you probably have, but if you haven't, or you know people who haven't been able to come to terms with their mortality at any age, especially young people, all right, that's so important. That is so important. And if you are able to do that, then you're able to be a better caregiver to somebody, all right, which is the second major reason I wrote the book. When I work with these beautiful, beautiful men and women, mostly women, but I would make matches with other men and then I would follow up to see how things were going, and they would also share their thoughts with me. They have so much to say, not only about life, but how they want to be cared for. Before the book was completed, I had an opportunity to put some of the lessons that I learned from my special friends into practice, because I was diagnosed with breast cancer. It's been about a year and a half now, and I was faced with this life-threatening illness myself. And I learned so much from them, and I understood what they meant when they told me how they wanted to be cared for. I found that when people knew that I had this diagnosis, everybody came up to me and said, "What can I do to help?" Everyone wants to know what they can do to help, all right, beside bringing meals. And what I've done is, in the chapter called Walking Them Partway Home, is to list the typical questions that people have of somebody going through a crisis, and I answer it as if I am the person and speaking like they really would like to talk to you. And then I go through and tell you what you really can do. For example, people would come to me and say, "How are you?" Now, "How are you?" is a typical American greeting. "Hi, how are you?" "Fine, how are you?" And you go on about your business. But if somebody knows that you have a terrible situation that you're facing, they'll come over to you and say, "Hi, how are you? how are you really? If you say fine, they won't accept fine. They'll say, no, how are you really? And then they want to know the medical details. They want to know, what did the doctor say? Are you in remission or not? And that was very difficult. And I was told that for many, many years, that people don't like to be confronted with, how are you? How are you really? Because they spend time talking about their condition with their doctors and their family members, and they live with it in their brain all the time. And here they're out to church, or they're at the grocery store, or they're taking a walk down the street, and someone stops them and says, how are you really? And they say, I don't want to have to deal with that. I just want to take a walk in the sun, you know? So, I address how you can relate to people in those different circumstances. So the third part of the book, after dispelling the fear of death and talking about the practical things that you can do, not only, by the way, the first chapter in part two is handling the practical details. It's about wills and trusts and so on and so forth, but it's not how to do it, because there are many books written on the subject, and you've got many professionals out there. It's full of stories. In fact, the entire book is full of vivid vignettes of the little snapshots of people's lives to illustrate the point. And in fact, my attorney is here right now, Kay Cross. She made sure that everything in there was absolutely correct. And I really appreciate your help, Kay. Then the third part of the book, after you get through the practical details, addresses what many people ask me, because I've had to help my own family members go through this dying process. My mother, my grandmother, many people, and my uncle just passed away 2 months ago, and he had hospice care. And they wanted to know, how does it feel to care for somebody in the middle, of your family, circle? It's one thing to know that you've been a caregiver to friends or acquaintances or even strangers that you're matched with through a caring ministry. But when you have to care for someone that close to you, how does it differ? And they had many, many questions along those lines. And I didn't know what else to do except to recount the story of the last 9 days of my mother's life. Now, this was a very, very difficult decision, because when you read the book, you're going to know so much more about me than I you, and it does reveal a lot about our family dynamics and the emotions involved, and it's not always pretty, But I did it as a way to answer the question, what does it really feel like, and what is it actually like at the end of somebody's life? In fact, even before, you get into that, the detail of Mom's last 9 days, the last couple of chapters in part two kind of recapture some very profound lessons that I learned from people who were in the final stages of life. Lingering lessons from the dying is one chapter that comes to mind. And I think you'll find it very revealing and very profound. I am sure that many of you could have written this book yourself, all right? You don't get to be of a certain age without going through a lot of ups and downs in life. I just happen to have had, I guess, the calling, the passion to pull it together and put it in writing this way. I'm not a celebrity. I'm a person who doesn't have a following. I'm not a Joel Osteen or a Rick Warren or a Joyce Myers. I'm just like you, and I try to pull it together in language that everyday people could understand, and just talk to your heart about life and death, and hopefully it will open up a dialogue, among your family members and friends, and promote some very stimulating discussion, not only about how to prepare for our ultimate healing, I should say, right? But also how to enjoy life and live it more abundantly. You don't want to be like the people that I've met and at the end of your life be telling somebody about the shoulda, woulda, couldas, and the regrets. If we can learn and capitalize on each other's experience, then we will be able to end our time here on Earth with no, and certainly few, regrets. Thank you very much for coming, and I'd be happy to entertain some questions right now. Any questions? Tell me, why did you come today? What were you hoping to hear or gain from this book or from this conversation, this discussion?
My wife told me to.
My wife told me to come. All right. Where is she, Van? She's coming. Yes, ma'am.
And his children have a very difficult time with the idea of thinking being ill.
Yes.
And so, this time, to, I think it's pastoral counseling, children, and I think that we do a lot of therapy.
Yeah. Yes, well, yeah, well spoken, well said. I think the book will bolster you. It will reinforce the things that you already know and believe. I think the book can also be used to give to somebody, to let them read, because it's not coming from you. And if your children read the book from somebody else, it might provoke some thought and give them a different point of view and start looking about life and death differently. And I use myself as an example because I go through in the first part of the book my transition from that fear of death and not wanting to talk about it. I mean, I would hug the walls of funeral homes if I had to go to visit somebody. I mean, I was terrified. And that transition was absolutely amazing. It was miraculous. And that might help them. And that's one of my hopes that the book will accomplish. How are you? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Right. That's right. I started when people would come to me and say, "How are you?" I ended up saying, "Well, how do I look?" And they'd say, "Well, you look fine." And I said, "Well, there you are. It's not how you feel. It's how you look and who you know that matters after all, isn't it?" And a little humor was able to dispel that awkward moment, and we would change the subject, you know. Sure. Good morning, good afternoon, or hi, how are you? They say, "Fine." And you just continue on the conversation. Yeah, you can say, "How are you?" but not, "How are you?" Really? Okay. Anybody else? Yes, ma'am. Mara.
Oh.
Well, I reached into my purse to get this little slip of paper because you reminded me of something that I read today when you talked about when we spoke on Christmas Day that you felt that we shared an experience because you've had some similar experiences. And someone sent me, you know how you get the forward on emails, beautiful pictures, but the verses on each photograph were from the Dalai Lama. the Dalai Lama's thoughts for 2009. And the one that struck me was this one. Share your knowledge. It is a way to achieve immortality. And that's one of the things I want this book to accomplish. This book is an honor, hopefully, and pays tribute to the people who have shared their knowledge with me. And if you find value in the pages of this book, then they have, in some way, achieved some immortality, you know, in the way that the secular world thinks about it. You know, I happen to believe in there is a life after death, so I believe that this is only the house we live in, and we will live forever. But that's a personal belief, and everybody has to come to terms with their own spirituality and their own understanding of God, and I just share mine. And God gives us, in my view, free will. And who am I to take that away from anybody? So you all have to walk this walk, the sacred walk, yourself. And nobody can do it for us. We have to do it individually. But I love that quote. Share your knowledge. It's a way to achieve immortality. So thank you for that, Mark. Anybody else? Hi, welcome. Mm-hmm. They're separate, but they can be hand to hand. My mother had a Stephen minister, and a Stephen minister is a person from a church who is there just to be a listening friend, someone to talk to walk with, to think through what you want to do with your time and your life, or how do you get over the situation. Sometimes the problem could be a chronic condition that's not going to go away. Coming to terms with that. Sometimes it's a problem that needs a solution, and you have to really think through the solution and walk with them as they go through that. So it is a Christian-based organization, all right? Hospice has wonderful services and paid volunteers who also can be a good listening friend. And my mom had the best hospice volunteer in the world. Her name was Helen Wonderly. And I loved her name because she was wonderful. And when my mom was matched with her, she would visit once a week. So there she had two people coming. A Stephen minister came one day of the week, and another day of the week a hospice volunteer came. Another day of the week a nurse was there, another day of the week, the doctor was there. So I had to build a network of support around her because I didn't live in the same city at the time. But this hospice volunteer, Helen, they found out they shared common interests and they loved to knit. In fact, Helen owned the store where my mother bought knitting supplies, years ago, and she had since retired. And they ended up knitting together my final Christmas present. I have a beautiful mauve-colored coat scarf that I will treasure forever. But that was Helen Wonderly said, Anna, you keep dropping stitches. You can't give it to your daughter like that, so I'll take it home and fix it. And she ended up adding the fringe to it. It was lovely. So and hospice is fantastic. One of the things that you'll learn from reading the book is that hospice truly is for the living. Most people are afraid of that word, hospice. People think that if you get call hospice in to help you, that it's a sign you're giving up. And you're not giving up. Hospice is there to provide you the amount of support that you need to help maintain quality of life. That's what they're there for. Yes, they're experts in pain management. But I was speaking to the chief medical officer of Hospice of the Piedmont, and we have multiple hospice organizations in the area. But I learned that so many of their hospice patients come from hospitals or from doctors at the very, very last part of somebody's life. Doctors don't like to give up. They're going to continue, trying to find a cure and work on you and keep you in the hospital or whatever as long as they can until they finally say, I can't do anymore. And that typically, from what I learned from the medical director at hospice, is about a week. Not very long. And the other place where they get referrals are from family members who have finally collapsed under the strain of trying to care for a loved one single-handedly. all right, instead of inviting hospice into the home. And when you investigate hospice and get under the layers, you'll find that there is support not only for the patient, but for the family members taking care of them. Respite care, someone to run errands, go to the cleaners, go to the grocery store. I mean, it is just wonderful. And experts in pain management, absolutely. But they're not going to do anything or administer, you know, drugs that unless the patient requires them or asks for them. They let the patient maintain control. That's one of the fears of dying, by the way, is when you read that chapter, is will I lose control? The fear of loss of my independence. How am I going to be able to cope with letting somebody care for me? I've always been the caregiver, and I'm afraid to let go. But when they make that step and they ask for help, another chapter is called The Luxury of Receiving Care, all right, the stress goes away. There is relief there. And I learned a statistic recently that says that people who are in hospice care actually live longer than people who don't have hospice. Yes, ma'am. Correct. Yes. I'm glad you brought that up because that is a myth. The question is, is there a limited time that hospice can be serving the patient or their family? You can go in and out of hospice. That's right. The criteria for getting into hospice care is the doctor saying, the primary, doctor saying that in their best, educated opinion, that the person has 6 months, in some hospices say 6 months to a year to live, all right? But once you make that decision to take advantage of hospice services and they evaluate you and say, yes, you are a candidate for hospice care, they will never stop serving you, all right? They will not withdraw hospice support from you if you've lived 6 months, a year, 2 years. I know some people who have lived under hospice care for 3 years. You can choose to not have hospice anymore. You can enter hospice care and then withdraw from it. You can be in one hospice organization and maybe move to another hospice organization. You are in complete control, right? And the beautiful part about it is this is a right that you have. You've been paying into, our taxes. Support this, Medicare or Medicaid, fund this along with donations, all right? So there's no out-of-pocket money that is required of the patient or their families. My mom got all of the medications, all the supplies, that she needed because we had her in hospice care within the home. My grandmother was in a residential hospice, and so she was there for only 3 weeks. And my mom was under hospice care for about 7 months, and not just the last week of her life. And by the time she got to that point in her life, she was being cared for, supported by hospice friends. They weren't strangers. And that's very awkward. You're really sick and you're dying, and you bring some stranger in. You don't know who they are, and they're with the hands on. It's just not as wonderful as it could be as if you've developed a relationship with somebody over a period of time. So I wouldn't hesitate to at least investigate. That's all I'm encouraging you to do. To call them and say, come and visit and see what you think. Let's talk about it and be very open about it. Thank you. Do I think an elderly person? Mm-hmm. Okay, if an elderly person, yes, I do, because my mother didn't want to have a Stephen minister, she didn't want to have hospice, but what you have to do is present it in the right way to dispel the myths. You don't want to have hospice because you think you're giving up. Let me tell you what I know and let me have somebody tell you firsthand, and you can ask questions. You don't have to see, the patient has to agree to having hospice. You can't force hospice on somebody. So they will come into the home and talk to you and your loved one and answer all the questions, and it's a mutual decision. So I think that will be the way to go, to really answer the questions, dispel their fears. Yes, ma'am. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. Yes. Thank you for saying that. Yeah. It's, all right. All right. Well, I'm glad you've heard it here first. And the book, Hospice is for the Living, will help reinforce it. It'll discuss some of the things we've talked about here and then some and tell you different stories about it. Okay? Yes, sir. Right. It's very, very difficult as a caregiver to accept the fact that your loved one is in the final stages of life. And when someone is in the final stages of life, certain things start to happen with them mentally, physically, emotionally. And one of the most difficult things is they're not wanting to eat or drink. All right, and for a family member, you must eat. You have to eat, Mom. You know, I have to feed you. That's what we do, right? We have to feed somebody to make them feel better. Have some chicken soup, anything. They don't want to do that. They are separating. They're disconnecting. I'll tell you one little story. Mom told me I was washing dishes, and she had an open floor plan in Florida, and I could see her sitting on the couch in the living room, and all of a sudden, I heard her say, "Hey, Don." I said, "Yeah, Mom." She said, "I think I'm getting ready to go. I don't think I'm going to be here much longer." Well, you can imagine. I put that dish towel down so fast, like my hands went in and said, "Tell me more, Mom. Why do you say that?" She said, "I feel like I'm separating, like I'm starting to disconnect." You know, she stopped reading newspapers. She lost interest in food. She would still taste things. She would eat a little bit, you know, and be very pleasant about it. But it wasn't important to her anymore. She was preparing. She knew what was happening. And things were happening in her head that I can't possibly imagine. But when she said, "I feel like I'm separating," I remember saying to her, and it was almost like a gift from God, because who would know what to say in that situation? And I said, "Well, Mom, I guess that's how it's going to happen. The weaker your body gets, the stronger your spirit gets. And they're pulling against one another. And one day you'll just break free." And she said, "What's for dinner?" You know, but it was like you would get these little snippets. You know, and that's a privilege to be there and to be just listen to what they have to say and say, "Tell me more," and they'll talk to you. It's just wonderful. I don't know if that answers your question or not, or just tells you. It's a very, very special, unique time in our life to help somebody make a transition. You know, I call this a sacred walk, but you really can't walk them completely home. You can walk them partway home. You know, walking them partway home is one of the chapters in the book. All right? It's special. Question up here. In my experience, in general, generally speaking, it's harder for the people that I've dealt with. But I just lost an uncle who wasn't sure what he believed. And we visited him like a day and a half before he died. And he said, I don't know where I'm going. I don't know what's next. He said, I've always believed that maybe there's something more to life, to beyond this life, but I don't know. And I don't believe what you believe, you know. So he was in between, but yet he had peace because he kept working. He was in show business. He was a choreographer, and he choreographed his tribute. So the last week of his life, he spent planning the last show. And when we had his tribute, it was 3 hours long with singing and dancing and everything. And he felt kind of good about leaving this world that way. But he was not the kind of person who was comfortable revealing his innermost thoughts. So he didn't talk to his children or to his wife. From my conversations with her, he kept that very, very private. Right, so my other experiences, though, have been, and I've talked about that in the book, a couple of situations, stories of people who had no faith at all, and then those who did have faith. And there was a marked difference in how they approached the end of their life, right? So I wish I could give you a better answer than that. Everybody's going to do it differently, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes, yes. That's right. That's right. Everybody wants hope. Everybody wants hope. I find that even the atheists and agnostics, when they get to that end, they're not really quite sure. They want to know. They want to know there's something. There may be something else out there. I don't know. It's my experience. Okay? You're welcome. I think we probably will conclude now and let you get on about your day. If you would like me to sign any of the books, I'm here.